Good day. Today is Tuesday, 7th July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now today, Tuesday, 7th July 2026, happens to be the first day of what looks like a very short NATO summit meeting in Ankara in Turkey. However, instead of starting with that media topic, which I think is actually in some ways less consequential, I'd like to return firstly to a discussion both of the military situation in Ukraine itself, but also to my discussion yesterday, my programme yesterday, of the interview that was given by Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, to Pavel Zarubin, important Russian journalist, over the course of which Peskov said that what had begun as a special military operation in Ukraine had evolved into an actual war, the blame for which rests with the Western powers, who have enabled or participated with Ukraine in long-range drone strikes deep inside Russia, for which they have also been providing satellite guidance. And, well, he seems, at least to me, to be leaving open. In fact, I would actually go beyond that. He seemed to me to be hinting that the days when we were looking only at a special military operation were drawing to an end, and that sooner or later, at some point in the not very distant future, the special military operation would be upgraded, I thought more plausibly, to an anti-terrorism operation, which would have legal consequences and legal significance. Now, unsurprisingly, a lot of people, or at least not maybe a lot of people, but several people, several well-informed and serious people pushed back against this. They said this is perhaps Peskov going a bit on the deep end, talking more loosely than he intended, and that one should not draw too much from this. And it's also been suggested, and I've seen this suggested in one or two places, that instead of an anti-terrorist operation, or rather if there was a decision to upgrade the SMO into an anti-terrorist operation or something like that, it would not first be hinted at in this way in an interview by Peskov. Well, I am in turn going to push back against all of those comments. Firstly, I think it's worth pointing out that this was an interview which Peskov gave to Zarubin, who himself has struck me for some time as being extremely close to the Kremlin and very closely attuned to the Kremlin's thinking. He is the journalist to whom Putin almost exclusively gives interviews, and I believe that he actually has a television show which is focused mostly on what is supposedly taking place in the Kremlin, which appears to me, so far as I know about it, to follow very closely the official line, but peppered with quite a lot of inside information, which he's obviously been intentionally given by well-connected Kremlin insiders. So what I'm saying is this, is that both Zarubin and Peskov are themselves extremely well-connected individuals, close to Putin, if in somewhat different ways, probably well informed about discussions that are taking place in the Kremlin. This is not an interview given by Peskov, in other words, to any journalist. It's an interview given to Zarubin, who is practically a semi-detached member of the Kremlin bureaucracy himself. So that's the first thing. And I would suggest that given that the interview was held and conducted in this way, we should take what these two are saying to each other seriously, because it probably does mirror Kremlin thinking. The second point, though, is that at some point, Putin and the Security Council in Russia are going to have to decide what they're going to do with the SMO anyway. And we are now drawing closer and closer to that point. Because with the fall of Konstantinovka and the shortly to be announced fall of Liman, and with further information coming from the battlefronts, which I'm going to discuss shortly in other parts of this programme, we will be coming very close indeed to the moment when the whole of Donbass, of Donetsk and Lugansk regions, has, as the Russians say, been liberated, or as others would say, captured and cleared of Ukrainian troops. Now, the original objectives of the special military operation, as Putin announced them in February 2022, that they were not limited to Donbass by any means. They contain provisions, for example, about Ukraine's neutral status, its position outside NATO, the need for its demilitarization, the need for its denuclearization, the need for the liquidation within Ukraine of all individuals and groups and entities, or at least maybe not liquidation, but the suppression within Ukraine of all manifestations of the ideology of the 1930s and 1940s, which has achieved such strong hold there. Even allowing for all of that, the SMO, its military objectives, its initial military objectives, and the task that the Russian army was specifically given in February 2022 was to clear Donbass. Now, the point is that that is going to happen relatively soon. It may happen in the next few months. It may happen before the end of this year. But nobody disputes that relatively soon, at some point within, shall we say, the next year, to be generous, it will have happened. At that point, the question then becomes, what next? Well, obviously, there is unresolved business to do in Zaporozhye and Kherson region. Though, again, as I will discuss shortly in this programme, the situation in Zaporozhye region is also accelerating, and it's starting to look as if events in Zaporozhye region are going to develop only a little more slowly than they are in Donbass. But anyway, my point is that it's hardly realistic to expect that after the fall of Donbass, even allowing for the need for military operations to clear Zaporozhye and Kherson region, that absent a negotiated settlement, the war can simply end. Because not only will many of the original objectives of the SMO, as set out by Putin in February 2022, have still not been realised, we would still have the insistence of the Western powers, at least the European Western powers, and the Ukrainians, that Ukraine is on an irreversible path towards NATO. There's actually a treaty between Britain and Ukraine, signed by Zelensky and Starmer, which actually uses those words. Well, not only is there that treaty and that objective out there, but all of the other things that Putin has been talking about, the original SMO has been talking about, neutral status, demilitarization, denuclearization, suppression of the noxious ideology of the 1930s and 40s. Not only will none of these things have been achieved, but the Ukraine of today is, even once it loses Donbass, Zaporozhye and Kherson region, in most respects, still a dangerous adversary and problem for Russia, and in some ways, arguably, an even more dangerous adversary and an even bigger problem for Russia than it was in 2022. Today, Ukraine is cooperating closely with the European powers. They have been providing Ukraine with missiles and drones. Those missiles and drones are being used by Ukraine to conduct strikes inside Russia. The current government of Ukraine, Zelensky and his officials, have made it absolutely clear that they will not agree under any circumstances to the loss of Donbass, any more than they have agreed to the loss of Crimea, and of course that they won't agree to the loss of Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. So if the Russian army captures the four regions and then stops, many of the underlying problems that led to the SMO in the first place will remain unresolved. And of course, if the Russians were to agree to some kind of a ceasefire on the existing conflict lines, which would at that point include the four regions, it would mean the four regions being fully under Russian control, well, there would in theory still be nothing to prevent a major rearmament drive by Ukraine, perhaps its admission into NATO, and steps taken by the Ukrainians, backed by the Europeans, and maybe eventually the Americans, to renew the war at some future time, if only to recapture all the lost territories again. And even if there is no straightforward renewal of the war, there would continue to be tension. There would be a military build-up in Ukraine. If Ukraine were to join NATO, it's likely that long-range missiles and all of those things would be positioned within Ukraine, long-range missiles supplied by NATO, all of those things. So, as I said, it's difficult to imagine that, short of some kind of comprehensive settlement with the West, the Ukrainian crisis at that point would be over. But if the status of the SMO is left unchanged, whilst after the four regions have been captured or liberated by the Russian army and cleared of Ukrainian troops, then if we are still talking about an SMO, what is the status of any additional territory that the Russian military then capture? The Russian military have been capturing territory in Kharkiv and Dnipropetrovsk and Sumy region at a considerable rate over the last few months. And again, I will be discussing all of that shortly in this program. At the moment, because Sumy region, Kharkiv region, Dnipropetrovsk region are not covered by the original provisions of the SMO, the Russians are preserving the fiction that they're simply occupying these Ukrainian territories in order to establish a buffer zone. But if long-range strikes from Ukraine continue, if attacks on Russian troops in these four regions continue, if there is continued tension and conflict, well, you can only go on expanding territory that you can control and pretend that it is a buffer zone up to a certain point until it becomes unreasonable to continue to pretend that it is just a buffer zone. At some point, the military, Gerasimov and the general staff, are going to come to Putin and are going to ask for clearer orders. What is it that he's ordering them to do? And they will want all of that codified in some kind of proper legal format. And if that means going beyond, extending beyond the boundaries of the four regions, then they will want something, it seems to me, that is going to be an upgrade on the original SMO. Now, if we are discussing something else, an anti-terrorist operation, and note that the Russians have been talking a lot recently, Putin has been talking a lot recently about how much of what Ukraine is doing in terms of its attacks inside Russia and its drone strikes on Russia. Putin, the Russians have been saying that a lot of this amounts to terrorism. They call it terrorism. Then it becomes logical, it seems to me, to upgrade it to an anti-terrorist operation. Because then you have a more coherent legal framework which is better adapted, far better adapted, to the realities once Donbass, Zaporozhye and Kherson region, the four regions in other words, have been secured. Because not only at that point are you able to go after Zelensky himself and the other top Ukrainian officials, something which apparently, under the terms of the SMO, the Russian military and security services are not able legally to do. But since we're talking about an anti-terrorist operation, it doesn't have the clear geographical limits that the SMO does. So I expect that the pressure to rethink the terms of the SMO and to upgrade it will inevitably grow, and I suspect that they are already there. I think that what we're looking at in Moscow, what with Putin's words, he's dwelling on the fact that the Ukrainians are conducting terrorist outrages inside Russia, The fact that other Russian officials, Shoigu, Medvedev, Lavrov, have been saying the same sort of thing. And of course, these comments of Peskov in this interview to Zarubin, I think what they're all doing is providing us with preparation. They're laying the ground for the fact that eventually, perhaps at some point towards the end of this year, perhaps sooner, that upgrade in the status of the SMO is coming. It's coming, as I said, because sooner or later, the military are going to insist on it. Anyway, for the record, I don't see any end to the conflict in Ukraine until there's some resolution of the political situation in Kiev. I don't think that there is any foreseeable future in which the Russians can coexist with the Ukrainian government led by Vladimir Zelensky, just to say that straightforwardly. And I think at the very minimum, the Russians are going to demand that. Almost certainly they are going to seek for other things. It seems quite clear to me that guidance or even an order was probably given late last year that once Zaporozhye and Kherson have been cleared, the Russian army is to go on advancing westwards towards Odessa itself. Again, I'm going to return later in this program to what is happening in Odessa. So already we can see that things are evolving significantly. But already it seems to me the framework of the original SMO is reaching bursting point, and I suspect that the demands to change it, to change its framework, the legal framework of it, are going to increase, so that these objectives that the Russians will now wish to achieve can be, from their perspective, legally achieved. No one should underestimate the extraordinary punctilious legalism with which the Putin government goes about its business. I know a lot of people are profoundly cynical about this, overlooking the fact that two of the most important people in the Putin government, Putin himself and Medvedev, arguably Putin's number two, are trained lawyers. But to anybody who has followed the way in which it does its work over the years, the many years of its existence, well, they will understand the nature of the points I have just been making. And I would say that the same punctilious, almost obsessive legalism seems to me to guide the general staff and the Russian military as well. Anyway, that's what I want to say about this. I doubt that by this time next year, we will be talking about an SMO anymore. These, of course, are my opinions. Anybody who wants to push back and argue against them and explain why they think I am wrong is, of course, welcome to do so. Now, having, as I said, started with all of this, I think it is worth saying a little, or starting now, with the actual situation on the front lines and in the conflict as a whole. And I'm going to return again to this enormous strike that the Russians conducted on Kiev and the Kiev region, which I discussed in my previous program. The most powerful strike that the Russians have conducted against Kiev, in my opinion, in fact, indisputably, since the start of the special military operation. There have been other Russian strikes where perhaps the total number of missiles used was greater, but no previous Russian strike concentrated so many missiles on one specific target, and no previous Russian strike concentrated so many missiles on that target, which is the Ukrainian capital, Kiev itself. And I would add that the missiles, the type of missiles now increasingly used, Iskander-M ballistic missiles and Tsarkon hypersonic missiles, appear to me to be far more powerful and carry much more powerful explosive warheads and achieve far greater impacts than the subsonic cruise missiles, the KH-101s and the Kalibr missiles, which were essentially the only missiles that the Russians used in missile strikes on Kiev and other Ukrainian cities earlier in the war. So anyway, I wanted to say all of these things, but let's now turn to the big strike on Kiev, because there has been a very important development, and that is a absolutely colossal explosion at one particular, it's described as a factory, but it's clear that it was more than just a factory. It was also a arsenal, a depository of what many are speculating were cluster shells and depleted uranium shells supplied to Ukraine by the United States. And I've now seen footage of the explosion, and it is enormous. And you can see an enormous column of flame and fire dominating the landscape around this factory. As I said, the effect is devastating, and apparently it continued for many hours. And you can also see debris falling. And since we're talking about depleted uranium shells, there's a chance that some of these shells, the dust discharged by this explosion will also have been, will have contained elements of radioactivity. There's an absolutely devastating strike. And the dust and the debris fell across a micro district of Kiev, and it seems that the entire population of this micro district, I've seen reports that we're talking about certainly tens of thousands of people, has had to be evacuated. The Ukrainian Prime Minister, Mrs. Sidorenko, visited the area and said that this was the single most devastating strike that the Russians have carried out since the beginning of the SMO. Now, all of this is extraordinarily interesting in itself, but what makes it all very poignant is the question of why there were these depleted uranium shells and cluster munitions stored so close to Kiev in this particular facility. And I ask this question because, in my opinion, this is a legacy of the Biden administration. I remember that back in 2023, during the period of Ukraine's failed, ultimately defeated counteroffensive in Zaporozhye region, the counteroffensive that was supposed to break through to the Sea of Azov and to the Black Sea, to roll through the Surovikin line and to surround and encircle the Russian forces in Crimea, all of which it was confidently expected would knock Russia out of the war. Well, over the course of that offensive, when it became clear that breaking through the Russian defence lines, the Surovikin line, was turning out to be far more difficult than the Western planners and the Ukrainians had anticipated, it became clear that Ukraine was running out of shells. And the Biden administration, Jake Sullivan to be precise, who was Joe Biden's national security advisor, decided that in the absence of sufficient shells in the United States and in Europe to make up for Ukraine's massive shell expenditure during the offensive, that the United States would start to supply Ukraine with cluster munitions in order to enable Ukraine to keep the offensive going. And this was controversial because there'd been a major campaign around the world to outlaw cluster munitions. The United States had not signed up to that. But anyway, obviously, they put aside any inhibitions they might have had over the issue. And they went ahead and supplied the cluster shells, despite the fact that, as many people pointed out at the time, cluster shells are less effective in breaking through heavy fortifications than shells with conventional unitary warheads. So large numbers of these shells with cluster munitions were then supplied to Ukraine. And then, of course, the United States at this time also took the decision to supply Abrams tanks to Ukraine. And from memory, the first batch arrived in Ukraine in the autumn of 2023. And then the United States took the decision also to supply the armor-piercing shells that the Abrams uses, which use depleted uranium. So all of these munitions, the cluster munitions and the depleted uranium shells, all of them found their way to Ukraine. And then, of course, what happened was that the Russians defeated the 2023 offensive. The Abrams tank, well, basically failed in Ukraine. From what I can tell, they've all now been disabled or destroyed. But what is left of the shells was still there and was held in this big depository, where the Russians, of course, have just attacked and destroyed it. These shells, these depleted uranium and cluster munitions, did not in the end assist Ukraine to win any kind of battlefield on the battlefronts, any kind of battle on the battlefronts. What it did in the end was create this enormous explosion and this terrible situation in which large numbers of people in Kiev have had to be evacuated from their homes. Now, this attack on this facility was, of course, big and spectacular, but in some respects, since we're probably talking about weapons that had a historic use rather than a current one, it may have been less significant than much of the other damage that the Russians did over the course of this strike. And the Russians, alongside the strike on Kiev, of course, also continue their operations across Ukraine itself and their hunt for Ukrainian gas stations, gas filling stations in the eastern Ukrainian region. And I was reading this morning a report in the official Russian news agency, TASS, which has obtained information from someone who it refers to, as a Russian security official. And it quotes this official as saying, in the Sumy region, the Ukrainian armed forces have no gas stations left on the main roads. This is also confirmed by plans by regional Ukrainian authorities to ban the retail sale of gasoline starting on the 10th of July. And then TASS continues. In late June, the Russian Defense Ministry reported several strikes on key energy facilities used by the Ukrainian military in the Kiev, Sumy and Chernihiv regions, as well as in parts of the Donetsk People's Republic. According to TASS calculations based on Russian Defense Ministry reports, the Ukrainian military have lost nearly 35 gas stations over the past week and a half. So that's one thing that the Russians have obviously been doing. They have been destroying the gas filling stations in eastern Ukraine behind the battle fronts, intended to complicate the logistics of the Ukrainian military in eastern Ukraine, to make it more difficult for the Ukrainians to send supplies to Donbass and Sumy and Chernihiv, where there are the rumours that the Russians might mount their next offensive, and Kharkiv region, of course, as well. And by the way, though TASS doesn't mention this, the same has also been happening in Zaporozhye region too. So that campaign by the Russians continues. In fact, the Russians continued with it last night. And last night, they began to release more drone footage of the attack and destruction of some of these gas stations in eastern Ukraine. And I'm guessing that the drone footage came from the drones that attacked the gas filling stations. And since these are Geran drones, that confirms that some Geran drones, increasing numbers of Geran drones, are equipped with optical sensors. The footage provided is incredibly accurate, incredibly clear. And given that the Russians are unable to use Starlink to guide their drones in order to conduct these strikes using these optical means, again, that reinforces my belief that at least some parts of the Russian RASVET system, the Russian equivalent to Starlink, are now operational and are being used by the Russians on the battlefronts. A number of people have pointed out that so far the Russians have not been conducting deep strikes with their drones in western Ukraine, at least not in this sort of way, with optically guided drones maneuvering and attacking specific targets. And probably, for the moment at least, the RASVET system is insufficiently developed to allow deep strikes in the far west of Ukraine in the same way that Starlink enables the Ukrainians to conduct strikes deep inside Russia. But, well, we can see the direction events are taking. Anyway, for the record, the Russian Defense Ministry also says, not just the Russian Defense Ministry, but the Russians are also saying that the last big Ukrainian drone strike, the one involving over 600 drones, was the biggest drone strike on Russian territory that the Ukrainians have carried out up to now. And the Russians are also saying that one of the targets undoubtedly was Moscow itself, but none of the Ukrainian drones reached Moscow, and that overall the strike was unsuccessful and did minimal damage. And I think, based on what we're seeing, what I'm hearing and reading, it's difficult to argue with that proposition. The Ukrainians did carry out a drone strike on a giant Russian refinery in the Siberian city of Omsk. The distance the Ukrainian drones would have covered would have been enormous if they were launched from within Ukraine, but there is some speculation that they were actually launched from inside Russia by Ukrainian sabotage teams, which is at least possible. Anyway, this is the biggest refinery in Russia, just to say. And apparently, notwithstanding that it is located so far from Ukraine, there were air defences constructed to protect it, and it seems that nearly all the drones that the Ukrainians launched against this giant facility were brought down by the Russian air defence. But there is, again, a column of smoke, which one can see in the general area of the refinery. Some are speculating that it means that a Ukrainian drone hit and did damage to the refinery. I have difficulty always watching Ukrainian drone footage or any kind of drone footage. I believe this drone footage was actually made by a Russian, film footage was actually made by a Russian bystander, not by a drone. But for the record, the smoke column looked to me relatively small. So I don't think here we're looking at a refinery fire or anything like that. It seems to me more likely that a drone was shot down, landed perhaps on some building or other, and that was what produced the smoke that we see in this film. Overall, it doesn't appear as if much damage to this gigantic refinery was done. The reality is, and again, this is something that many people, I think, in the West are very resistant to accepting, but the reality is that the last succession of Ukrainian drone and missile strikes against Russia, the long-range strikes from within Ukraine, have been, well, basically unsuccessful. Hundreds of drones have been launched. Even if one allows for the cheapness of many of these drones and the fact that they're made of prefabricated parts, this is a very significant industrial effort, to say the least. and one which must have come at a significant financial cost. But it is not achieving very much. In fact, I'm going to make a guess that if we're talking about the very long range strikes inside Russia, the cost of the strikes themselves, perhaps over the last few weeks, exceeds the cost of the damage done inside Russia as a result of the strikes. Anyway, that's my own view. Again, I predict there will be some pushback over it, but anyway, it is my view. Now, the Ukrainians have also been conducting drone attacks on commercial shipping in the Sea of Azov, which of course they claim is still their own territory, their own internal sea, even though the Russians have basically established total control over it, over every part of it, since their capture of the city of Mariupol. And a fact which is very little known and which has gone almost entirely unreported. The Russians have just won a legal case in the International Court of Justice over control of the seas around Crimea and over control specifically, from what I can tell, of the Sea of Azov. I mentioned that I don't place a huge amount of weight on it because, of course, nobody's going to pay much attention to ICJ judgments. Anyway, the Ukrainians have been conducting drone strikes on some ships in the Sea of Azov. I don't think these strikes are being done by the big, or rather by the bigger aeroplane type long range drones that are being launched against targets inside Russia. I think this is much more likely. These attacks are much more likely being carried out by medium-sized drones, like perhaps adaptations of the American Hornet drones that the Ukrainians have been using against the roads in Zaporozhye region and in Crimea. My guess is that any damage done to a large container ship by a single drone is going to be, well, it's going to be relatively slight. Again, ships are almost by definition extremely strong things, made of steel mostly. A drone with a few kilos of explosive can only do a limited amount of damage overall. But, of course, it produces an interesting picture. It might alarm some ship owners. One can understand why it is being done. Which now brings me to an interview that Vladimir Zelensky gave yesterday to the Financial Times on the eve of the NATO summit meeting in Ankara. Over the course of it, Zelensky went out of his way to say that what now is happening on the ground is of really no importance. The situation on the ground is sort of at a standstill. The really important thing is what is going to happen in the sky. According to Zelensky, the Ukrainians have won the war at sea, an extraordinary statement, a ridiculous one, in my opinion, which I have debunked in many programs. But anyway, let's move on. The Ukrainians supposedly have won the war at sea. Territorial gains by either side are now of only minimal importance. It is he who wins in the sky who is going to win the war. And, well, Zelensky, of course, talked up the success of his big drone offensive against Russia. There has, by the way, now started to be increasing amount of sour commentary in Ukraine itself, especially after the massive Russian strike on Kiev, asking what exactly is happening to this great 40-day campaign that Zelensky ordered a few days ago, about a week ago, against Russia. Why isn't it achieving the results that he said it would? But anyway, Zelensky talked up his great campaign, his great drone campaign, with its deep strikes against Russia. But of course, he came back, as he always does, to demands for more weapons and more money, lots of money, and above all, more weapons. And the weapons that he's asking for now are more Patriot missile interceptors. And it is now universally acknowledged right across the media in the West that Ukraine is out of Patriot missile interceptors. Whatever remaining Patriot missile interceptors Ukraine recently acquired from Poland have apparently already been used up, and perhaps some of them were destroyed in warehouses over the course of the big Russian strike on Kiev. But basically, Ukraine is now without air defense interceptors, which explains, supposedly, why the Russian missiles are able to get through unobstructed. And, well, maybe not so much in this interview in the Financial Times, but certainly other Ukrainian officials are now basically coming forward and saying that the West, the Europeans, must basically give to Ukraine every single missile interceptor, Patriot missile interceptor, that they have left. Ukraine supposedly has put in orders for fresh Patriot missile interceptors. They will be provided sometime in 2027. We are not told when exactly in 2027. They will be coming straight off, fresh from the production line. And, well, what will then happen is that the Ukrainians will kindly part with these new Patriot missile interceptors. They will exchange them for the Patriot missile interceptors that they're expecting to receive from the Americans next year. They will exchange the Patriot missile interceptors they're going to receive from the Americans next year with the Patriot missile interceptors they will receive in the meantime from the Europeans. Except, of course, that that isn't what is going to happen. Because let's just take a step back and assume that the Europeans do as Zelensky asks them and give him all the remaining Patriot missile interceptors that are still there in Europe. As night follows day, when next year comes, if the war in Ukraine is still underway, well, by that point, Ukraine will have used up all of the Patriot missile interceptors that the Europeans will have given them, which, of course, will never be enough. And Zelensky will then say that he can't give any Patriot missile interceptors he's receiving from the Americans because he needs them to defend the skies over Ukraine. In fact, he's going to complain bitterly that those Patriot missile interceptors he's getting from the Americans are nowhere near enough. He's going to demand even more. He's going to basically demand that most or all of American production of Patriot missile interceptors should be provided to him. He's going to do that because that is what Zelensky always does, and it is what he's going to have to do anyway, because, as has now been well established, production of Patriot missile interceptors in the United States simply cannot keep up with global demand. And in fact, there's been a detailed study of production of Patriot missile interceptors in the United States. You can read all about it in the latest piece that Simplicius the Thinker has published on his Substack site. It points out that the supply chains that lie behind Patriot missile interceptors are massively complex, with huge numbers of small businesses all involved in them in some way. I happen to know that a lot of the production is by hand. And, well, basically it takes 2 years to produce a single interceptor. So the result is that production is very slow and extremely difficult to scale up, and the costs of scaling up production are enormous. This is the story of Western weapons production altogether. So the announced target that Raytheon has given itself of producing 2,000 Patriot missile interceptors a year by 2033, in other words, in 6 years' time, I understand is unlikely to be achieved, or at least that is what the industry believes. In fact, it might not be achievable at all. Even if it is achieved, 2,000 Patriot missile interceptors a year is still not going to be enough Patriot missile interceptors for Ukraine. They almost certainly are going through more than that in any single year. So this is a demand that is just going to go on increasing. I have been making this point since 2023. I said back in 2023 that supplying Ukraine with Patriot missile interceptors was going to deplete the inventory. So, of course, has happened. But apparently, the imperative, the obsession to go on supplying Zelensky with more and more Patriot missile interceptors never, ever ceases. I suspect that the Europeans will, even if they don't give him all their interceptors, will end up giving him a very significant proportion of them. And at the end of this process, as I said, Ukraine still won't have enough Patriot missile interceptors. And the gaps in air defense coverage in Europe will have grown hugely greater. A further point I have been repeatedly making in program after program is that all the talk of increasing defense production in Europe is essentially so much talk. Industry cannot meet the demands European policymakers are making. The supply chains in Europe and the production systems in Europe are even more complicated than in the United States itself. But beyond that, however many weapons the Europeans make, especially if we're talking about missiles, the Ukrainians will always demand more, as long as the war in Ukraine continues. Europe will be disarming itself rather than rearming. Now, the one exception, of course, is drones. The Europeans can indeed produce a significant number of drones. But here again, it doesn't in any way diminish the force of my point, because as is now well established, the greater part of the production of these drones does not take place in Europe, and certainly not in Ukraine. It takes place in China, which then exports the drones to various third countries, which then in turn re-export the component parts to Europe, where they are, all the various parts are then put together, sent off to Ukraine, which then tweaks them up a little bit, pretends that they're Ukrainian drones, and launches them against Russia. In other words, the one weapon that the West, or at least the Europeans, are producing in quantity isn't really being produced in Europe at all, because it rests on the back of Chinese production. Just to say. Anyway, that's the big message about weapons production and about Zelensky's demands. But of course, the very interesting thing about his interview was the way in which he was now minimizing the facts about the ground war. He doesn't really want to talk about them. He certainly wasn't asked any difficult questions by the Financial Times about the situation in Konstantinivka. Of course, he denies that Konstantinivka has been captured by the Russians. There are some people in the West, of course, who believe him. I said yesterday that the pictures of Ukrainian soldiers raising flags in Konstantinivka, some of them might have been made in perfect good faith before Konstantinivka fell. Some of them may have been made by Ukrainian soldiers hiding in Konstantinivka, who received instructions from Kiev to come out of their hiding places and wave their flags. Perhaps the soldiers were told that doing so would attract supplies from the large Ukrainian drones that send supplies by air. Anyway, it turns out that there may be some truth to this claim that, as I said, the Ukrainians have ordered soldiers hiding in Konstantinivka to come out and show themselves and wave flags, because the Russians claim and have produced some pictures. Of course, I can't verify all of these pictures, but the Russians have produced some pictures of what they say are captured Ukrainian soldiers who followed Kiev's orders and came out in Konstantinivka and waved flags in the way that the authorities in Kiev told them to do. Now, again, I don't want to speak more about what is happening in Konstantinivka than I actually myself know. I am not there. But to repeat again, putting aside, or rather, notwithstanding this flag-raising stunt or imagery that the Ukrainians put out, I have absolutely no doubt at all that Konstantinivka itself is firmly under Russian control. Now, there's been a lot of further news from the battlefronts over the last few hours. Firstly, there are Ukrainian reports that Russian reconnaissance groups have broken into or broke into the Slavyansk, the territory of the Slavyansk thermal power plant, one of the last big fortified barriers before the Russians reach Slavyansk itself. The Ukrainians say that they were able to drive these Russians out of the Slavyansk thermal power plant. Again, I am not there, but I am going to assume that this claim is true. More importantly, however, it does now seem that some fighting is indeed taking place in the important nearby town of Nikolaevka, which is now apparently the major Russian objective east of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. There have also been reports that the Russians have now entered Druzhivka or other places connected to Druzhivka at the southern end of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation. And we are, of course, still waiting for news about the situation in Liman. My guess is that the Russians are now waiting to announce the fall of Liman. It's going to coincide with the NATO summit meeting, and the announcement will probably be made over the next few hours or days. As to the overall situation with the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation, I've been saying basically since the special military operation began that it looked to me as if the Russians ultimately are planning the creation of a cauldron around these two cities. I recently learnt from Stanislav Krapivnik some more information concerning this, that apparently west of Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, it's basically open steppe for many, many kilometres or miles. And the point is that in terms of the other battles that have taken place in other Donbass cities, Bakhmut, Toretsk, Chasiv-Yar, Avdeevka, even Konstantinivka, there's always been another big fortified city behind these cities which the Russians have sought to attack. There's been another city, another big fortified town that the Ukrainians could retreat to. With Slavyansk-Kramatorsk, this is simply not true. Putting aside the fact that the Russians are fairly soon going to be in a position to cut the supply lines to these two cities with their drones and their artillery, and apparently they are now advancing west of Konstantinivka and west of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk to achieve that very thing. Putting all that aside, retreat from Slavyansk, Kramatorsk across open fields or open steppe land would be absolutely disastrous. Any soldiers trying to escape from Slavyansk and Kramatorsk would face, well, horrendous results, as I remember happened on a much smaller scale following the fall in October 2024 of the town of Ugledar, where the Ukrainian garrison also tried to escape across open steppe land. And, well, the majority of them were tracked down and captured or killed. It's one of the most horrendous, horrific events of the war up to this time. And Stanislav Kapryvnik has made a further point, which is that if the Ukrainians wait until the autumn Rasputitsa before they retreat from Slavyansk Kramatorsk, if there is a Russian push to capture these two towns, which corresponds with the Rasputitsa, the time of the marshy ground, well, the idea of troops trying to escape from Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, my guess is mostly at night, across open fields, huge expanse of open fields, continuing for tens of kilometers, fields which have been turned into practically swamp. Well, the idea just doesn't bear thinking about. Scott of Calibrated recently suggested that the wiser policy for the Ukrainians would be to retreat from Slavyansk and Kramatorsk now, before that disaster happened. But I've said already, I don't expect it to happen. And judging from Zelensky's comments to the Financial Times, I have to say that it does look to me as if the garrison, the soldiers who are going to be ordered to try to hold these two towns, are about to be sacrificed in the most ghastly way. So that is one thing I would say about the war. Now, in other places, the Russians appear to be making significant advances in Kharkiv region. As I said already, Beli Kolodezh in Kharkiv region appears to be in the process of being stormed. And though I don't myself believe that there is street fighting going on in Orekhov in Zaporozhye region, the Russians are bombing and shelling Orekhov heavily in ways that suggest that a storming operation is about to begin. And again, Stanislav Kapryvnik has pointed out that Russian troops are now closely positioned very closely to the main supply roads leading into Orekhov from the north and the west. And already it is likely that the Russian drones and the artillery are intercepting most vehicle traffic that tries to move along these roads. Again, all of the information campaign about how Ukraine is winning the initiative on the battlefields is not only factually wrong, it is appallingly wrong. The situation is getting much worse, and the situation of the Ukrainian army in place after place is deteriorating hideously. There was a very interesting summary of the war up to now by Larry Johnson on his indispensable Substack site, Sonar 21. He pointed out that in 2024, the year after the Russians defeated Ukraine's summer 2023 offensive, in 2024, the Russians basically advanced along one axis westwards from Donetsk, capturing Avdiivka, Selidovo, Kurakhovo, Ugledar, bringing them all the way up to Zaporozhye region and close to Pokrovsk. In 2025, the Russian offensive changed its character. It became an offensive not just in one focus part of the front line, but across the entire front line. And in 2026, the pattern of 2025 has been repeated, except that the offensive, the Russian offensive, on every part of the front line is becoming more intense, and especially in the northeast of Ukraine, in Sumy and Kharkiv region, it is becoming much, much more powerful. So pretty much everything that you read at the moment about a stalemate is not only wrong, but it is wrong in a way that, if followed through, is going to doom a very, very significant number, proportion of the Ukrainian army to a very horrible fate by the end of this year. Anyway, my friend Ian Proud has also written an extraordinary piece on his Substack site, The Peacemonger, in which he discusses how the West's financial aid to Ukraine, something also Zelensky incessantly talks about and wants, how the financial aid the West has given to Ukraine has also worked against Ukraine's interests. First of all, he points out that if you totalize the aid provided to Ukraine over the last 4.5 years since the start of the special military operation, if you totalize aid, add military and civilian aid, and lump them all together, then Ukraine has received more in aid from the West than its GDP. In fact, 2.5 times more than its GDP. And yet, its nominal GDP is about the same as it was at the start of the war. Well, that is, of course, completely artificial. Nominal GDP is simply propped up by all this enormous flood of Western aid. True GDP, actually organically generated GDP in Ukraine, has collapsed. Ian Proud also points out that if you're talking about industrial production in Ukraine, that has reduced by about a third since 2022. Though I think myself that this is a big underestimate, because the figures given focus mostly on production by the big industrial companies that receive support and which are involved in the war effort. If you're talking about small-scale business, small businesses, small and medium-sized businesses, my sense is that production there has collapsed completely. And, well, just by way of comparison, economic growth in Russia this year is likely to be around 1%. As I've said, this is mostly due to interest rate policy. I've had some pushback against that, but I maintain that position. But I saw that in spite of the fact that industrial growth, manufacturing growth in Russia, this year is expected to come out about 1%. The machine building complex in Russia has grown 8% year on year in the first 6 months of this year, with production of certain types of goods, especially electronic goods, increasing much faster. The Russian economy continues to evolve and change and technologically upgrade, whereas Ukraine's is in deep decline. And, well, we all know about the population fall in Ukraine, though nobody is able to give exact figures, about the large numbers of people who have left Ukraine over the last 4.5 years, and about the toll inflicted by the heavy casualties that Ukraine indisputably has suffered. So these are the realities. As I said, all of this talk about Ukraine regaining the initiative is simply concealing those realities. In fact, what it is doing is that it's encouraging or enabling Ukraine to keep going in ways that are going to make what is already a very, very bad situation much worse still. And now we come to the NATO summit meeting. Now, this apparently is going to be very short. There's going to be a dinner and a single plenary session. Zelensky is not going to be invited to speak because Trump, as is well known, can't stand him and wouldn't be happy if he did speak, but he is nonetheless going to be there. The entire NATO meeting is going to last all of 2 days. There will be, of course, more commitments made to Ukraine, supposedly in order to help Ukraine in its hour of need. But in reality, all of this help is simply luring Ukraine further up that primrose path that Professor John Mearsheimer talked about all those years ago, the primrose path ultimately to its own destruction. Because in the sky, on the ground, in terms of losses, the war continues to be lost and badly lost. In the economy, it continues to be lost as well. And coming back to the points that I made at the start of the program, when, not if, the Russians do decide to upgrade the SMO, well, by that point, negotiations of any sort are going to be, well, a topic that is far behind us. My own view is that the major reason why Putin has held back from upgrading the SMO into something else is that until, say, 6 months ago, there was still some residual hope in Moscow that a diplomatic resolution might be achieved, and it was understood that upgrading the SMO would stand in the way of that. The Russians have essentially given up expecting a diplomatic resolution anymore. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov, has again all but said as much. He said that in comments The warmonger party, represented by the ruling circles of Britain, Germany, and France, as well as the leadership of the EU and NATO, seek to win over the Americans, who, judging by their rhetoric and recent actions, are increasingly moving away from the concept of resolving the Ukraine issue through negotiations and compromise. In fact, Washington has aligned themselves with Europe's stance on how to approach the conflict in Ukraine. And, well, he all but rules out negotiations. He says recent statements by Europeans about their readiness to resume dialogue with Russia are nothing more than a diversionary tactic. The aim of the European Union and its member countries is to increase their role as the militarized vanguard of the anti-Russian West and to preserve the Kiev regime as an instrument of the constant military pressure on Russia. The military preparations of the Europeans carried out under the slogans of impending high-intensity war with Russia are difficult to perceive as anything other than preparations for armed aggression against Russia. We do not see conflict. We do not have aggressive plans. However, we will undoubtedly fight back against any encroachments on our vital interests, as well as attempts to use the language of ultimatums with our country. So that was what Ryabkov said. So the Russians do not expect negotiations. They basically written off the prospect of negotiations with the Americans. The reason for keeping the special military operation as a special military operation, in other words, are falling away. And as I have just said, it seems to me that the Russian military, before very long, certainly after Donbass falls, are going to come back to Putin before long, request further instructions, which, in the absence of a diplomatic resolution, which now looks impossible, must mean an upgrade of the SMO. When that happens, Ukraine will already be in crisis. And the option of a diplomatic resolution will have been completely thrown away. Well, this is where I finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.